alcoholic, and I'm grateful to know that. And my name is Sunshine. It is such an honor and a privilege to be with you here on this Sunday morning. And I want to thank the committee for asking me and blessing me with the honor and the privilege to be here. I'm humbled by this and truly grateful to be able to just share with you a little bit about my story in hopes that we recover and that there's something that is said or read or something that is shared from my heart to your heart that encourages us to move forward in recovery and live a life beyond our wildest drunken dreams. I'm a child of the 60s. I guess you can tell by the name Sunshine, right? I was born and raised in the Bronx to Puerto Rican parents. And, you know, the home of Bacardi, a.k.a. Bacardi in English. And we use all of our resources on the island, and we bring them here to the States, and we use them here in the States as well. My folks came over to New York when they were very, very young and got married, and I'm their love child. And what I know about growing up Puerto Rican is that, A, we're loud, and B, we like to drink and party. I also know that we are loving people, and that we come from the island. It's called La Isla de Encanto, the island of enchantment, and we're very hospitable people. And so I learned a lot about hospitality from my godmother, Tata. She lived in the Bronx, and on the weekends we would go to visit her. And you got to know that she was the hostess with the mostest, and she lived on the 19th floor of this co-op building, and we would go there because that's where the party was on the weekends. And it was something like this. We were very, very young, and we would ring the bell and get buzzed into the building and then take the elevator all the way up to the 19th floor. And as soon as the elevator doors opened, you can hear... Mind you... Her apartment was like way, way down the hall. And with the loud music blasting, I had no clue how she knew, because even before we rang the bell, she'd open the door. Mira, negrita, ¿cómo está? Negrita. It was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. She was toast. She had already been drinking. She was the kind of hostess that made you feel welcome, made you feel at home. The kids, we had a room to go to hang out and play while the adults had their playground. And she had this fully stocked bar, like all the alcohols with all these different names. And she was the hostess with the mostest. She would walk around and be like, your drink is halfway empty, depending on how you look at it, halfway full, halfway empty, right? But she knew what you liked to drink. And she'd pour it so that your glass was filled. And that's what I saw. This is what I grew up with. And what I got an opportunity to see is how people walked in all cool, calm, collected, you know, their shirts and their pants were very nice, or their skirts and dresses were very nice. And by the end of the evening, holy cow, these folks were unrecognizable. They were laid out. You know, they were... They would use a bathroom, and there was no bathroom there. They would literally be on the chairs and the tables. The music was really loud. People were screaming just to hear each other in regular conversations, just to talk to one another. But this is normal. And this is the environment that I grew up in. And I loved it. I loved it because I grew up to be proud and to be... proud of my family and proud of, you know, my people and who we are and where we come from and all that good stuff. And, you know, this is how we party. This is how we live. As a matter of fact, when they were new babies and they were teething, we would just take that Bacardi and rub it on their gums, and it's gonna be okay, little one. You know, it was almost like just putting a little, here, have some Bacardi. It's going to be all right, you know. I got to tell you that my dad died when I was 4 years old. My earliest memories of my dad are actually my my memories of my father were me and my younger sister in the house with my mom, and all of a sudden we hear the key in the door. Daddy's home. Come on. And we would go and we'd hide. We'd hide in the closet. We'd hide under the bed. Hiding in the closet was something I picked up really early. Hide under the bed. And my dad, Greg, would come in and he would say, "Hi, honey, where are the girls?" "I don't know." "What do you mean you don't know?" "I don't know. I haven't seen them." "Where are my girls?" "Girls, where are you, girl?" We'd be giggling in the closet or under the bed, hiding. And he's like, "Well, I'm looking behind the closet. They're not here. I'm looking here. They're not here." "Well, if I can't live without my girls, I can't live without my girls. So if I don't find my girls, I'm going to leave." "No, Daddy, no." And we'd just run out and hug him. And he would just love us and fill us with so much love and cuddle us and hold me. I felt so loved. And when my dad died at 4 o'clock, when I was 4 years old, they just told me he was sleeping. He was asleep, but he never woke up, and I never saw him again. And my mom was gone, because as a kid, I didn't understand that she was grieving the loss of her beloved, the man that she loved, the man that she had two children with and actually lost a pregnancy when he died. And so she was absent as well, grieving. So for me, there was a big hole, the loss of a love of a parent. And for me at that age, parents equals God. It's my first idea of God, of a love bigger than what I am, something greater. Without me even asking, I'm provided for. That's what parents symbolize for me at that young of an age. And so for a while, I looked and searched for the love that was absent. And absent and absent. I remember trying to people please. I learned how to people please because when we were 8 years old, we moved in with my grandmother after my dad died. And my grandmother and my mom had these parenting issues, you know. My grandmother knew how to parent. Obviously, my mom didn't know how to parent. At least that was their argument, and it involved my sister and I. I remember when we were very, very young, it was a summer sunny day, and we were on punishment, my sister and I. I don't even know what we did, but we were on punishment, and before you know it, my grandmother and my mother are at it, having these arguments. "The girls need to be outside. They don't need to be cooped up in this apartment. It's a beautiful day." "No, they're on punishment. You don't know how to parent. Yada, yada, yada. Da, 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 da. Woo, 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 woo." And before you know it, now the two people who symbolize God for me, my grandmother, my mom, attempt to commit suicide. My grandmother, we got drama too. We got drama. So my grandmother runs into the kitchen, she gets a knife, she lays down, she gives people plenty of time to get in there and rescue her, you know. She lays down, all proper, and then begins to try to thrust this knife through her chest, and everybody rushes, you know. "No, no, abuelita, ¿qué tú haces? Mira." So somebody saves the day, they take the, you know, knife away. And then a few minutes later, out of frustration, my mom makes a mad dash to her top drawer. She used to suffer from migraine headaches, and they used to give her codeine. And so she had, you know, a nice little bottle of freshly refilled, you know, codeines. And there she was. She makes a mad dash to the bedroom, opens the drawer, grabs the pills, again, with enough time to let people rescue. And she runs to the kitchen, and then, you know, tries to swallow all the pills. And that's my mom, right? So I'm kind of like, as a little kid, I'm really short, but she was only 5 feet tall anyway. And I'm trying to tickle her throat so she doesn't swallow. Because I knew that somehow, instinctively, that they would go to sleep too, and that I would never see them again. And again, these were the folks that provided for me. So for me, the search for love, the search to behave, the search to be, and I swore that day that I was going to be good no matter what. I was going to be good. I remember being in school with my first crush, Miss Kesselman. I was in the third grade, and I was sitting in the back, and I was just a chatterbox. And they'd be like, hey, how you doing? And the teacher would be like, okay, you got to be quiet, you got to come here, okay. And then I remember it hit me, Cupid's arrow hit me, and I was like in love with Miss Kesselman. And I remembered that I had to be good. That's what happened. Before I was a chatterbox, now coming back to school after this weekend incident, I had to be good. I had to behave. I couldn't get punished anymore because they were going to kill themselves. And I remember sitting in the back, and Miss Kesselman was handing out papers, and I was sitting up all straight. I said, Miss Kesselman, I ain't going to be a chatterbox no more. Because I just learned how to people please. Because I wanted love. I wanted you to be there. I wanted to feel this acceptance. I wanted to feel a part of something. And needless to say, I can tell you about hundreds and hundreds of stories in my life growing up where I was searching and seeking for love, where I was searching and seeking for acceptance, where I was searching and seeking just to be a part of something, whether it was a family or a group or something. And so it was no coincidence that when I found alcohol, that it was the answer to all of my living problems. Because as soon as I had that bitter, burning liquid do its thing, it was okay that I wasn't loved. It was okay that you didn't care about me or that you didn't care for me. It was okay because I learned that people die. It was okay because I knew there was no Santa Claus now. It was okay because I knew that growing up you had lied to me so that I can do whatever it was that you needed me to do so that you can get whatever it was that you needed to get. It was okay. This liquid courage that I started drinking and ingesting in junior high school gave me the courage to smoke pot, gave me the courage to meet people, gave me the courage to go to high school in Manhattan, an hour and 15 minutes away from the Bronx where I live. It gave me the courage to come out. It gave me the courage to be. Without it, I didn't know how to be. I didn't know that it was okay to be. I remember being in high school, and I remember drinking in front of the school and smoking pot in front of the school like it was the thing to do, like it was coffee and a donut. I remember that I had finally arrived, that I found some companions, I found some people who could do what I did and that they loved me. And they loved me because we were all drinking together. We're all engaging in partaking of this elixir that made us feel differently, this false courage. I remember making my first geographic out to California. I left home when I was 16, by the way. My mom would do everything for us. She washed my clothes. Only thing I had to do was my chore on Monday, which was to wash dishes and clean my room. And I remember my mom was washing my clothes for me, and she was taking my sweat socks and putting them in my drawer, and she found a card, and she opened up the card. It didn't have her name on it, and it wasn't in her drawer either, but she found it necessary to open it, and she opened the card, and voila, love your wife, Sandra. So she found out that I was a lesbian. And I forgot to tell you that we were Jehovah's Witnesses at the time. As a matter of fact, I need to backtrack to tell you how in love I was with this idea of God. and with going from door to door. I was, you know, one of those kids, I'd be knocking on your door, hi, we're Two of Jehovah's Witnesses, and today we're talking to people about the Bible. And we have these Watchtower and Awaits, which are a guide to the Bible, which will help you understand your Bible. Are you reading your Bible? And I knew my Bible because I was reading it, you know. Yeah, I was drinking a little here and there, too, but but I was reading my Bible. What's your excuse, huh? There had always been that longing and that searching, again, to be loved, which was what I talked about, you know, about my folks, my parents and my grandparents. So I really had a good time being a Jehovah's Witness. It was like a lot of fun for me, you know. We would do skits and stuff like that, have assemblies in big places. And I was even baptized by the time I was 13 years old. And so here I am 15, and my mom's reading this card, and she's finding out that I'm gay. So she confronts me about it, and she's like, hey, you know, are you gay? And I said, yes. And she proceeded to put me on permanent punishment. She threatened to send me to Catholic school. Scared and happy at the thought, actually. I figured, all the girls, wow. And then I got scared because I was like, if that's what they did to the Savior, what are they going to do to me? I know, I'm so sacrilegious. I don't know. At any rate, they disfellowshipped me. And what disfellowship means is they excommunicated me. They were here in the congregation just like this. And before everybody, they read a letter from the Christian congregation saying that I was engaging in behavior unbecoming a Christian, and therefore I was disfellowshipped. And everybody got up. All my friends, people who knew me, who I used to go knocking door to door with, they all got up and they looked at me and they didn't say a word to me. They could no longer even talk to me. I know, that was jacked up. I call it spiritual abuse now. Because here I was developing a connection. My life could have been different, but it is what it is, and I'm grateful for my life, exactly the way it planned out, exactly the way it has played out. What has happened, you know, what happened after that is that I ended up leaving home when I was 16, and I moved in with my girlfriend, and that gave me all the rights of an emancipated minor, which is all the rights of an adult. So I started going to clubs, I started drinking, I started, you know, engaging in other activities. And I made my first geographic to California. And it was wonderful. You know, the only thing that was jacked up is that I was 18 when I came out to California. You can't drink at 18 in California. Whoa, I didn't do my homework. But here was sunny Southern California. You know, I would watch the movies. My mom would watch Annette Funicello dancing on the beach, you know. And I was like, I'm going to California. It's beautiful out there. They were driving cars to high school and stuff. I was like, now that's for me. And I came out here, and I was way, way far from home. But it was beautiful. The only thing was I couldn't drink. I couldn't legally buy alcohol. And so, you know, I try to get Rich to buy alcohol for me, or Marnie to buy alcohol for me, or whoever was going into the liquor store. It was like, will you buy me some beer? Will you buy me some this? And sometimes I'd be successful, and sometimes I wouldn't. So needless to say that my alcoholism kind of took a turn to the left, because it was easier for me to get other things than it was for me to buy alcohol. But nevertheless, all of my activities were always enhanced by alcohol. Always. Everything was always better with a drink. Period. So needless to say, in 1984, the Olympics were coming to town, and I lived in Inglewood, California. And we couldn't show the world how jacked up Inglewood, California was. So, of course, the police started to clean up the area, and all of my friends who had gone from selling marijuana to selling other things, all of a sudden they were in jail, in prison, facing time. They were cleaning up the area. I was like, what's going on? What's happening out here? And I got out of Dodge, so I made my next geographic back to New York. And it was in New York that I met my first Eskimo. And for those of you who are new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. This program really, really works. It has saved my life. And it has saved the lives of many people that are sitting right here before you and among us. And in New York, I got this job. You know, alcoholics, we could do anything. We can sell a snow cone to an Eskimo. You know, it's just like, I had a job selling massage pillows, and I would sell these pillows on a daily basis and get cash. And so, you know, I'd walk in with a big old duffel bag full of massage pillows, and I'd put one behind your back, and it'd start vibrating, and it was giving you a massage while you were just sitting there. And I got paid cash every day for selling these pillows. And I remember that one morning I walked in. It was a cold winter morning in the Bronx, and I went from the Bronx to Manhattan for work, and I was sitting in front of everybody, and I was under the influence, and I started nodding out and just like falling asleep. I was just like so intoxicated. And I remember my manager, it was, you know, it was funny because our group meetings before we went out in the field were just like AA meetings, because they would be like, we want to thank Devin. She sold 30 pillows. Woo! And everybody be clapping. And we like, and so-and-so sold 60 pillows. And it was just like, yay. And we were just cheering each other on. It was a beautiful thing. What ends up happening is that my boss sees me and he's in recovery. And so he says, come here. You're not going out to work today. And I said, what's up? He goes, you're under the influence. I can't let you go. I go, no, I'm just really tired. And I need to go. I need to pay my light bill. I haven't paid a light bill in 6 months. I mean, you know, they're about to shut it off. But I finally convinced him to let me work. But in actuality, he let me go to work if I would go to some meetings with him. I had no clue what he was talking about. So I ended up going to these meetings with him. And all of y'all were there. And y'all were clapping and smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. And y'all were laughing hysterically, and there was nothing funny. Not a daggone thing. I didn't get it. So I figured that y'all were under the influence, but y'all were lying to me, because after all, everybody else in my life has lied to me. They told me about Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny, and they told me if I did this, I would get that. I mean, everybody lied to me. And y'all were doing the same thing. Y'all were lying. Y'all were saying you were sober, you were clean, you were doing this, doing that. You know, and it was like, yeah, right, whatever. You know, but I did see that y'all had glasses in your hand, just like at my godmother's house. And they were full, and y'all were drinking it. So I was like, what's up with those glasses? What's up in those cups? And so I proceeded to go to the coffee and get more and more and more, but I didn't feel it. Then I started noticing that at the end of the meetings, they would thank, you know, people, you know, I want to thank Joe for making the coffee. I was like, oh, it's Joe. Joe got the stash, huh? So, you know, later on, I put on whatever feminine charm I had. Hi, Joe. It was such drag. Hi, Joe. Joe didn't have it either. Then I started noticing that people were getting chips, and I was like, oh, that's it. I got to get some chips. Then they can give me some of the stash. And I was like, okay, cool. So, you know, this week I go and I get a 30-day chip, and then I go back next week and get a 60-day chip. I didn't know I had to wait 30 days in between, you know. I totally skipped that newcomer chip, that white one, you know. It's just like, and still nothing. But what happened was y'all kept laughing, and y'all kept telling me to keep coming back. And y'all kept showing me that a day at a time that y'all were staying sober. And I started to believe you, that you were telling me the truth. I kept seeing people who would relapse and who would keep coming back and talk about how desperate they were, what they felt like. So I got a taste of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I liked it. It gave me hope. So if you're new here, I hope that you hear the hope and that you get the hope, that you catch it. You know, I didn't stay sober. I didn't stay sober. I still had some drinking to do. And I ended up going back to California in December of 1985. And I came out here with a girlfriend, you know, who I had manipulated, who, you know, I dressed up. I knew how to, you know, really clean up and really look good. And the minute I got here, I found my old playgrounds and my old playmates in Inglewood, California. And, I'd left the hotel and I'd be gone for 3-4 days. And when I came back, she said, "Who is she?" "Well, she's not, like, human. She's alcohol. She's drugs." And I began to introduce her to my way of living and what I had become and what I had returned to in Inglewood, California. And it wasn't going to work. And so I tried desperately to do something different. I started going back to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started hitting other meetings as well, just trying to find that hope that I found in New York, trying to find that love. It was just a little glance of love, again, searching and seeking for that. And over again, I relapsed. I just wasn't ready. I was trying to do it to save a relationship. I was trying to do it to save a job. I remember going into a hospital program for 30 days, and I remember coming out of that hospital program, and I tell you, I was cured because I became an AA parrot. People would say, "We're going to ask Sunshine to come up and read chapter 5. And I would come up. I was a drama king. I learned it from my family. "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women," and I would go on and on. There's something to be said about following directions. They asked me to read chapter 5, not recite chapter 5. So needless to say, because I wasn't following directions, I didn't stay sober. I thought if I said what you said, and I sounded good, and I looked good, and my clothes were together, and I wore my gold jewelry, and I had the, you know, Mr. T starter kit around my neck, I thought that I could belong. I thought that that's what it took. You know, it was about money, property, prestige. It was about all of that, you know? And I had no clue that I had to follow direction. Follow direction. So needless to say, you know, I would get, like, I had about 4 months. And then I drank again. And then I would get, like, 3 months. And then I drank again. And before I knew it, because I wasn't still willing to surrender to win, not surrender and die, but because I didn't grasp that concept that if I surrender, I win, because it's a different concept, it's not common, but I hadn't grasped that yet. So I kept relapsing and relapsing and drinking, until finally, one day, I was out on one of those sprees that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about, and something happened for me. I came to, and let me tell you what I felt like. So if you're comfortable closing your eyes, you can. And if you're not, it's okay. But imagine, bring to your imagination for a moment a stray dog that has been hit by a car, that is limping, that has patches of hair missing from different parts of its body. Imagine that dog with fleas and its tail tucked between its legs, looking down, scraggly. Imagination is a powerful thing. pastors, aren't we? That was my cry for help. And it was in that moment that I totally surrendered to Alcoholics Anonymous. And by some miracle, I was able to get into a hospital program, and I had a sponsor when I had 4.5 months that I kept calling from time to time that I wasn't willing to surrender to. And in that hospital program, they took me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. They also told me that I needed to really surrender. I called my sponsor from that place and I said, hey, what do I need to do? And she asked me 2 questions. Are you tired? And from what I had just described to you, I was tired. And her next question is, are you willing to go to any lengths for your sobriety? And the answer was clearly yes. See, at that point in time, my way brought me to that place, to that point. But I was willing to surrender my will and my life. I was willing to admit that my life was unmanageable. I was willing to admit that everything that I knew how to do, and my searching and my longing for love in all the wrong places, looking for courage in the liquid, in the bottle, hadn't worked. And because I had been privileged to come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew that there was some hope. And I was willing to turn that little bit of hope into some action. And from that hospital program, I went into a recovery facility. And when I got out of that recovery facility, I began to walk a walk with my sponsor and some other women in Alcoholics Anonymous that has transformed my life. We took the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous from the first page, which was blank, and that's what I was told. I was told that I know nothing and that I had to come in here with an open mind, a blank slate, and that I had been renewed and I had been given a new canvas in which I can outpicture my life, a new canvas to draw my life upon. I was taken through the forward to the first editions, which told me that the purpose of this book is to show us precisely how we recover. I was told in the very beginning, that very first page, the next page, it says, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. We do recover. And I was taken through the doctor's opinion and told and taught that this is a disease, a dis-ease. I was taught that this is a disease of a threefold nature, the physical allergy, the mental obsession, and the spiritual malady. And that one day at a time, if I do what they did, I would get what they got and beyond. It was explained to me that I needed to find a power greater than myself, and I had a problem with that because you remember that, you know, Jehovah was no longer happy with me. But I was told that whatever little step I can make, that I can make the G.O.D., the group of drunks, my higher power. And what I didn't know that I had done is that I began to ask you, the group of drunks, my sponsor, Alcoholics Anonymous, to take my heart and to mold it. I had asked you to take my mind and transform it. I had asked you to take my will and conform it to your will. Because you, the group, the strength and the numbers, was my higher power. And when the group no longer worked as my higher power, I had to get a bigger God. And because this had worked, I was willing to have a bigger God, a bigger idea of this power greater than myself. I began to really look into the book, and it said, deep down within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Wow, that still small voice that I had been drinking to shut up was God. And I had let this committee, my alcoholism, my disease, my dis-ease, I had let that become what ruled my life. And little by little, my sponsor took me through the steps and helped that committee calm down a little bit. and help that still small voice speak to me in a language that I understood, to be my guide, to help me through situations that I thought were impossible to get through. Little by little, by examining the book and studying the book with a dictionary and a highlighter and a pen, we looked up words that I did not understand. We looked up words that I thought I understood, and I learned that I misunderstood some words. I began to do an inventory. I was scared to do an inventory because I was going to straight meetings, you know, and my sponsor was a lesbian big old dyke. Lovey C, Los Angeles, y'all know her. And she wanted me to do a fourth and fifth step, and I was scared because, see, I was going to all these straight meetings, and I thought, but if I do a fourth step, I might be straight again. Right. No! I had some misunderstandings. You know? I was scared. I was like, oh my gosh, God wants me to be heterosexual. I'm sure they have fun, but not as much as I was having. But she was able to let me know that, no, it's just an inventory. What you have, what you don't have, what you need. We were able to do a fourth step. We were able to complete a fifth step. I remember being scared to do my sexual inventory with her. I remember dodging her for days and days. And I'd be like, no, I can't make it over. No, this is before cell phones, you know. I'd be like, no, I can't come. No, I can't make it over. And then, you know, I go, I'm going home. I called her from a payphone, pulled off to the side of the road, called her from a payphone. I'm home chilling out, watching TV, thinking, yes, I don't have to do my sex inventory. Next thing you know, my sponsor's there knocking on my door. Pull out that sex inventory. Let's get through it, you know? What freedom? What freedom I got from doing my inventory, my resentments, my fear, my anger, my sex inventory, and getting rid of it. Finally being able to tell another human being everything about me. Finally feeling the love, finally feeling a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. How incredible to finally feel like I'm at home, like I have earned my seat, like there's nothing that I have to hide anymore. I can be me, I can be free. You know, and when I would have dreams about, oh my gosh, they're going to find out who I really am. So if you ever have those dreams, like, or if you ever get that fear, like, oh my gosh, they're going to find out who I really am. The question is, what am I withholding? What am I not telling my sponsor? What am I not telling another human being? I need to be fully, fully out. I have in this program, as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, been able to live a life beyond my wildest dreams because I was willing enough to allow my courage to come from within me instead of from alcohol. Because it takes courage to take these steps. And we all have that. It's already within us. Waiting to be activated, waiting to just be touched or brushed just a little bit so that it can really fully express in, through, and as us. I didn't want to look at my character defects, but I found out what they were. But because I'm willing to look at what these character defects are, I'm willing to look at what I want to be and what I really am. See, my character defects are really what I have become as a result of drinking. It's a result of what I had become because I was being dishonest and I was lying and I was cheating and I wasn't being authentic. I wasn't telling you, I want to be loved by you. I want to feel your love. I want to be a part of. I was too scared and too vulnerable. I was too afraid. I didn't know that I had to begin to learn to love myself and let that God presence within me love me. I was plagued by by fear. I was plagued by self-deceit. I was plagued by self-hatred. I was plagued by wanting money, property, and prestige. I thought that if I had those things, that I could be accepted. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, one day at a time, I don't have to have any of those things. What I get to have is a relationship with God so that I can be filled with the confidence, with the love, with the right sizedness. Bill W. talks about being 20-some-odd years sober and feeling the depression and feeling the hatred and just not feeling in sync. And it's because we forget. We forget to ask the questions. We forget to use our prayer, our meditation to ask those questions. God, what would you have me be today? What would you have me say? To whom would you have me say it? What is it that I need to release or embrace in order to feel your presence and live from that place more and more deeply? Life is waiting to express in, through, and as us. And when we walk around unconscious, hating ourselves, deceiving ourselves, we are not letting Alcoholics Anonymous do what it is here to do, what it is designed to do, which is to set us free. It's more than just not picking up a drink. Because we already have, for those of us who've been around for a minute, we already have physical sobriety. For a lot of us, our thinking has shifted. And we don't see the drink like we used to. But we still get to deal with our spiritual malady. And the more and more we focus on being whole now, the more and more we get to express and live from a place of fullness and a place of joy and a place of happiness. We are not a glum lot. If you go into Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and you walk out depressed because everybody's like, I lost my car, I lost my house, I lost my car. Get to another meeting. Because we do recover. We do live happy, joyous, and free. Yes, we have struggles. Yes, we get to learn how to live life on life's terms. But we are not made, we are not created to experience lack and limitation and doubt and fear and guilt and self-loathing. We're not here to cut on ourselves or drink or abuse ourselves or others. We're here to learn that there is a power that is available for our good. And when we use it for our good, good happens all around us. I gotta tell you what an honor it is for me to be here. Y'all just don't know what my life is like today. When I can lay my head on that pillow and know that my dis-ease is not active in my life. That I know that I haven't hit anybody over the head and grabbed their bag so I can go get a drink with the $2, $3 they had in it. You gotta know what comfort and joy comes from looking in people's eyes and just loving and experiencing the love that is just generated by us just simply being. It is incredible what happens when we really surrender and give ourselves over to this philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous, to this way of life. It may seem like the last house on the block, but it's actually the first house to the beginning of the rest of our lives. And that blank canvas that was given to me in the beginning has been painted with so many wonderful and beautiful experiences. And this one goes on there too. I want to end with my analogy. Most folks, my Overeater Anonymous folks, they'd be like, are you going to tell the cake story again? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, ooh, I'm going to show up. And I love this analogy because it tells a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous, what Alcoholics Anonymous is to me. If I make a cake and you like it, you say, dang, Sunshine, that was a good cake. Let me get the recipe. And I take the time to write out the recipe for you. Painstakingly write it out. You take it home. You're all happy. I'm gonna make some sunshine cake. I'm gonna make some sunshine cake. And you pull out the recipe and it says, use 2 cups of milk. Milk? I don't like milk. Yuck. I'm gonna use orange juice. Yeah, I'm gonna use 2 cups of orange juice. Use 1/4 cup of sugar. I like sugar. 1/4 cup? That's not enough. I'm gonna use 2 cups of sugar too. Well, you already see where I'm going with this, right? You're not gonna get the same cake because you're not following the recipe. And it's the same thing with Alcoholics Anonymous. The first 100 men and women painstakingly, through their experience, through their strength, through their hope, they documented the steps for us. It's the recipe for life if you be alcoholic. And all we have to do is follow the direction. And we too will have what they had. The story of how thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. We do recover. And no matter who is sitting in your seat right now, you need to know that you deserve recovery, that you deserve love, that you deserve life, and that you deserve abundant life simply by being human and by being spirit within this human body, having this human experience. We have a blank canvas today. So now it's up to us to follow the recipe and put on that canvas a life beyond our wildest dreams. Thank you. Wow.